They made three trips together to three separate banks and wound up at a fourth, where she made the final deposit and bought a cashier's check made out to Mr. T. and Mrs. M. Hobie in the sum of $19,650. The bank guy put it in a creamy envelope and she zipped it into her pocketbook. Then they walked back to Broadway together, holding hands, so she could pack for the trip. She put the bank envelope in her bureau and he got on the phone and established that United from JFK was the best bet for St. Louis that time of day. Cab? She asked. He shook his head. We'll drive. The big V8 made a hell of a sound in the basement garage. He blipped the throttle a couple of times and grinned. The torque rocked the heavy vehicle side to side on its springs. The price of their toys, Jody said. He looked at her. You never heard that? She said. Difference between the men and the boys is the price of their toys? He blipped the motor and grinned again. Price on this was a dollar. And you just blipped away $2 in gas, she said. He shoved it in drive and took off up the ramp, worked around east to the Midtown Tunnel and took 495 to the Van Wyck and down into the sprawl of JFK. Park in short term, she said. We can afford it now, right? He had to leave the Stire and the silencer behind. No easy way to get through the airport security hoops with big metal weapons in your pocket. He hid them under the driver's seat. They left the Lincoln in the lot right opposite the United building, and 5 minutes later were at the counter buying two business-class one-ways to St. Louis. The expensive tickets enabled them to wait in a special lounge where a uniformed steward served them good coffee in china cups with saucers, and where they could read the Wall Street Journal without paying for it. Then Reacher carried Jody's bag down the jetway into the plane. The business-class seats were two on a side, the first half-dozen rows. Wide, comfortable seats. Reacher smiled. I never did this before, he said. He slid into the window seat. He had room to stretch out a little. Jody was lost in her seat. There was room enough for three of her, side by side. The attendant brought them juice before the plane even taxied. Minutes later, they were in the air, wheeling west across the southern tip of Manhattan. Tony came back into the office with a shiny red Talbot's bag and a brown Bally carrier hanging by their rope handles from his clenched fist. Marilyn carried them into the bathroom, and 5 minutes later, Cheryl came out. The new skirt was the right size, but the wrong color. She was smoothing it down over her hips with vague movements of her hands. The new shoes didn't match the skirt, and they were too big. Her face looked awful. Her eyes were blank and acquiescent, like Marilyn had told her they should be. What are you going to tell the doctors? Hobie called to her. Cheryl looked away and concentrated on Marilyn's script.
I walked into a door, she said.
Her voice was low and nasal, dull like she was still in shock. Are you going to call the cops? She shook her head.
No, I'm not going to do that,
Hobie nodded. What would happen if you did?
I don't know,
she replied, blank and dull. Your friend Marilyn would die in terrible pain. You understand that? He raised the hook and let her focus on it from across the room. Then he came out from behind the desk, walked around and stood directly behind Marilyn, used his left hand to lift her hair aside. His hand brushed her skin. She stiffened. He touched her cheek with the curve of the hook. Cheryl nodded vaguely.
Yes, I understand that, she said.
It had to be done quickly, because although Cheryl was now in her new skirt and shoes, Chester was still in his boxers and undershirt. Tony made them both wait in reception until the freight elevator arrived, and then he hustled them along the corridor and inside. He stepped out in the garage and scanned ahead, hustled them over to the Tahoe and pushed Chester into the back seat and Cheryl into the front. He fired it up and locked the doors, took off, up the ramp, and out to the street. He could recall offhand maybe 24 hospitals in Manhattan, and as far as he knew, most of them had emergency rooms. His instinct was to drive all the way north, maybe up to Mount Sinai on 100th Street, because he felt it would be safer to put some distance between themselves and wherever Cheryl was going to be. But they were tight for time. To drive all the way uptown and back was going to take an hour, maybe more. An hour they couldn't spare. So he decided on St. Vincent's on 11th Street and 7th Avenue. Bellevue over on 27th and 1st was better geographically, but Bellevue was usually swarming with cops for one reason or another. That was his experience. They practically lived there. So St. Vincent's it would be. And he knew St. Vincent's had a big wide area facing the ER entrance where Greenwich Avenue sliced across 7th. He remembered the layout from when they had gone out to capture Costello's secretary. A big wide area. Almost like a plaza. They could watch her all the way inside, without having to stop too close. The drive took 8 minutes. He eased into the curb on the west side of 7th and clicked the button to unlock the doors. "Out," he said. She opened the door and slid down to the sidewalk. Stood there, uncertain. Then she moved away to the crosswalk without looking back. Tony leaned over and slammed the door behind her, turned in his seat towards Stone.
"So watch her," he said.
Stone was already watching her. He saw the traffic stop and the walk light change. He saw her step forward with the crowd, dazed. She walked slower than the others, shuffling in her big shoes. Her hand was up at her face, masking it. She reached the opposite sidewalk well after the walk light changed back to don't. An impatient truck pulled right and eased around her. She walked on towards the hospital entrance, across the wide sidewalk. Then she was in the ambulance circle, a pair of double doors ahead of her. Scarred, floppy, plastic doors. A trio of nurses standing next to them, on their cigarette break, smoking. She walked past the nurses, straight to the doors. Slowly. She pushed at them, tentatively, both hands. They opened. She stepped inside. The doors fell shut behind her.
"Okay, you see that?"
Stone nodded.
"Yes, I saw it. She's inside."
Tony checked his mirror and fought his way out into the traffic stream. By the time he was 100 yards south, Cheryl was waiting in the triage line, going over and over in her head what Marilyn had told her to do. It was a short and cheap cab ride from the St. Louis airport to the National Personnel Records Center building and familiar territory for Reacher. Most of his stateside tours of duty had involved at least one trip through the archives, searching backward in time for one thing or another. But this time it was going to be different. He would be going in as a civilian, not the same thing as going in dressed in a major's uniform, not the same thing at all. He was clear on that. Public access is controlled by the counter staff in the lobby. The whole archive is technically part of the public record, but the staff take a lot of trouble to keep that fact well obscured. In the past, Reacher had agreed with that tactic. No hesitation. Military records can be very frank, and they need to be read and interpreted in strict context. He'd always been very happy they were kept away from the public, but now he was the public. And he was wondering how it was going to play. There were millions of files piled up in dozens of huge storerooms, and it would be very easy to wait days or weeks before anything got found, even with the staff running around like crazy and looking exactly like they were doing their absolute best. He'd seen it happen before from the inside many times. It was a very plausible act. He'd watched it with a wry smile on his face. So they paused in the hot Missouri sunshine after they paid off the cab and agreed on how to do it. They walked inside and saw the big sign, "One file at a time." They lined up in front of the clerk and waited. She was a heavy woman, middle-aged, dressed in a master sergeant's uniform, busy with the sort of work designed to achieve nothing at all except make people wait until it was done. After a long moment, she pushed two blank forms across the counter and pointed to where a pencil was tied down to a desk with a piece of string. The forms were access requests. Jody filled in her last name as Jacob and requested all and any information on Major Jack Nunn Reacher, U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division. Reacher took the pencil from her and asked for all and any information on Lieutenant General Leon Jerome Garber. He slid both forms back to the Master Sergeant, who glanced at them and dropped them in her out tray. She rang a bell at her elbow and went back to work. The idea was some private would hear the bell, come pick up the forms, and start the patient search for the files. "Who's working supervisor today?" Reacher asked. It was a direct question. The sergeant looked for a way to avoid answering it, but she couldn't find one. "Major Theodore Conrad," she said reluctantly. Reacher nodded. Conrad? Not a name he recalled. "Would you tell him we'd like to meet with him, just briefly? And would you have those files delivered to his office?" The way he said it was exactly halfway between a pleasant, polite request and an unspoken command. It was a tone of voice he'd always found very useful with master sergeants. The woman picked up the phone and made the call. "He'll have you shown upstairs," she said, like, in her opinion, she was amazed Conrad was doing them such a massive favor. "No need," Reacher said. "I know where it is. I've been there before." He showed Jody the way, up the stairs from the lobby to his spacious office on the second floor. Major Theodore Conrad was waiting at the door, hot weather uniform, his name on an acetate plate above his breast pocket. He looked like a friendly guy, but maybe slightly soured by his posting. He was about 45, and to still be a major on the second floor of the NPRC at 45 meant he was going nowhere in a hurry. He paused, because a private was racing along the hallway towards him with two thick files in his hand. Reacher smiled to himself. They were getting the A-grade service. When this place wanted to be quick, it could be real quick. Conrad took the files and dismissed the runner. "So, what can I do for you folks?" he asked. His accent was slow and muddy, like the Mississippi, where it originated, but it was hospitable enough. "Well, we need your best help, Major," Reacher said, "and we're hoping if you read those files, maybe you'll feel willing to give it up." Conrad glanced at the files in his hand and stood aside and ushered them into his office. It was a quiet, paneled space. He showed them to a matched pair of leather armchairs and stepped around his desk, sat down and squared the files on his blotter, one on top of the other, opened the first, which was Leon's, and started skimming. It took him 10 minutes to see what he needed. Reacher and Jody sat and gazed out of the window. The city baked under a white sun. Conrad finished with the files and studied the names on the request forms, then he glanced up. "Two very fine records," he said. "Very, very impressive, and I get the point. You're obviously Jack Nunn Reacher himself, and I'm guessing Mrs. Jody Jacob here is the Jody Garber, referred to in the file as the General's daughter. Am I right?" Jody nodded and smiled. "I thought so," Conrad said. "And you think being family, so to speak, will buy you better and faster access to the archive?" Reacher shook his head solemnly. "It never crossed our minds," he said. "We know all access requests are treated with absolute equality." Conrad smiled, and then he laughed out loud. "You kept a straight face," he said. "Very, very good. You play much poker? You damn well should, you know. So, how can I help you folks?" "We need what you've got on a Victor Truman Hobie," Reacher said. "Vietnam? You familiar with him?" Reacher asked, surprised. Conrad looked blank. "Never heard of him. But with Truman for a middle name, he was born somewhere between 1945 and 1952, wasn't he? Which made him too young for Korea and too old for the Gulf." Reacher nodded. He was starting to like Theodore Conrad. He was a sharp guy. He would have liked to pull his file to see what was keeping him a major behind a desk out in Missouri at the age of 45. "We'll work in here," Conrad said. "My pleasure." He picked up the phone and called directly to the storerooms, bypassing the master sergeant at the front desk. He winked at Reacher and ordered up the Hobie file. Then they sat in comfortable silence until the runner came in with the folder 5 minutes later.
That was quick,
Jody said.
Actually, it was a little slow, Conrad said back. Think about it from the private's point of view. He hears me say H for Hobie, he runs to the H section, he locates the file by first and middle initials, he grabs it, he runs up here with it. My people are subject to the Army's normal standards for physical fitness, which means he could probably run most of a mile in 5 minutes. And although this is a very big place, there was a lot less than a mile to cover in the triangle between his desk and the H section in this office, believe me. So he was actually a little slow. I suspect the master sergeant interrupted him. Just to frustrate me.